We are C.S. Lewis fans, and whenever C.S. Lewis fans gather, we have a C.S. Lewis society formed. There are official C.S. Lewis societies, some very large ones. Carol, both Carol and Nancy have read his recent biography. I'll just give you sort of an introduction to this, and my own introduction to C.S. Lewis in a way, because I did exchange a letter with him. So I'll be talking a little bit about his letters. We introduce you to one of the truly great minds of this century, and remarkable people. I say this century, he was really born in 1898, died the same day as John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And my regret on that is letters, and I'll start right off here by saying that when you're writing a letter to a person, don't carry it around, get it written and sent, because I had a letter to him ready to send the week that he died. He wrote a lot of things, about 372 things, in fact. I imagine around 40 of these were books. There's variously numbered at 36 to 40, but they'll probably get into that. They're 45. I have read, I guess, most of them, but I don't remember very many of them. Well, I remember some of them, but they have had a great influence on me. He is really a remarkable author. Spent most of his time at Oxford, and from 1953, when he got the chair in medieval English at Cambridge, went down there, but he still kept his house in near Oxford, called the Kilns. He was one of the members of the Inklings, which I think you folks will probably tell about in your autobiography, which is a very interesting group of people. There's been some recent books on him that are truly remarkable, and I think one of the best ways to get a flavor of him is his fairly recent thing called Christian's Reflections. Well, it isn't that recent. It's just that I recently purchased it. And in this, he just covers a lot of subjects. Christianity and literature, Christianity and culture, religion, reality or substitute, on ethics, the poison of subjectivism, the funeral of the great myth, on church music, historicism, the Psalms, and he has written a book on the Psalms, which, you know, I say, boy, that's how can anybody liven up the Psalms sort of and write about them, but it's really a great and helpful book. The Language of Religion, Petitionary Prayer, he's a great one on prayer, Modern Theology and Biblical Criticism, The Seeing Eye. So you get a real introduction to him, except for his children's books. He did not like to write children's stories, yet he wrote the most remarkable set of children's books there is. You can get them in a set called the Narnia series. There are seven of them, and I usually buy the large bundles of the first one, and I get them from James Thin in Scotland, and I give them to all the little kids when they get to be about five or six. So if your kid hasn't got one and you can't afford it, let me know and I'll send him one, except my supply is only down to two and I got to order some more. But I get them from James Thin because I used to get them for 40 or 50 cents. I'm not trying to beat you out of any business here at home. The Lion and the Witch in the Wardrobe is the one I'd always give out. And that's the first one in the series. It deals in fantasy. The Lion, the Witch in the Wardrobe, it's even good reading, but even children of six or seven will realize that the lion is Jesus. And there are seven in the series, The Horse and His Boy, and Karn will give you the other five. Huh? The Dawn Treader.
Nancy's got them right there.
All right. The Dawn Treader, I mentioned The Horse and His Boy, Prince Caspian, The Last Battle,
Silver Chair.
Magician's Nephew. Okay.
That was not Norbert.
And a lot of other helpful books. Now, I'm just going to read you a couple of things that gives sort of his philosophy, and then I'm going to turn it over to this, except for read a couple of letters. Shortly after his conversion in 1929, and the person really responsible for this, in great part, was his reading of George MacDonald, who's also a very great guy, and he got some of his ideas also for his fantasy from there, from Fantasties, I think, and Lilith, and And C.S. Lewis wrote to a friend, "When all is said and truly said about the division of Christendom, there remains by God's mercy an enormous common ground." From that time on, Lewis thought that the best service he could do for his unbelieving neighbors was to explain and defend the belief that has been common to nearly all Christians at all times, that enormous common ground which he usually referred to as mere Christianity. He was a thorough-going supernaturalist, believing in the creation, the fall, the incarnation, the resurrection, the second coming, the four last things, death, judgment, heaven, and hell. His defense of mere Christianity was colorfully varied, depending on which part of the line needed defending. To that part which seems thinnest, he naturally went, adapting his tactics to suit his audience. And he often wrote in fantasy, because he could reach more people that way. And probably one of his most remarkable books, as far as helpful to other people, and I know it's had a great influence on people we have sent it to, who are out there searching, and that's called Mere Christianity. Mere Christianity. Truly a great book. And another thing that is very, very useful to get some insight onto him was the thing Light on C.S. Lewis by a number of people who knew him well. And it's Light on C.S. Lewis. I wanted to just quote, I think, one or two things in here. Opposition was indeed true friendship. Because they would really, he was a great one for controversy to argue and discuss. And he was pretty hard to best. In this, but he was great for this, and a great he was great on criticism, and he criticized me in my letter that I wrote to him, and what I feel so bad about, I lost it, but I'll give you the introduction to that. When Al Robness first met me, or I met him, he came to Richland for a series of meetings, and it was before his son Paul was killed. And his son, he was looking forward to Paul's return very soon after he was getting back to St. Paul. And his son Paul had been over to see C.S. Lewis and spent an afternoon with him while he was an Oxford scholar. And he was also Al Rognes's son Paul was very fond of George MacDonald and The Diary of Old Soul and other things. And when Paul was killed, on him were some of George MacDonald's poetry and writings. And that caused, of course, the Diary of an Old Soul, which is a poetry for every day of the year. By George MacDonald, has an introduction to it by Al Rognes. But Al Rognes sent out then a letter after Paul's death, but he also wrote one of the most greatest eulogies ever written. It was called He Was Only 24. I have used it here on another occasion or two, and I commend it to you. It's a remarkable eulogy, and so I wrote C.S. Lewis and sent him this eulogy and told him that Paul was killed. I also suggested to C.S. Lewis that if he had any objections, that some of us would put together, we'd collect up our favorite of C.S. Lewis and wondered if he had any that he would suggest. And he took offense at that. He thought this eulogy was really great. And he thanked me very much for it. And it was at a time when he was feeling very bad, and he said so in his letter. He did have trouble in his later years. I also asked him who Chad Walsh was. He took offense at that somebody to talk about his own writing, and to give you how he felt about his own writing. You can go to his secretary, or the fellow that sort of took care of him in later years and was his secretary, whose name is Walter Hooper. He says, "If it could talk, C.S. Lewis's waste paper basket might tell the perfect bibliographic story. Lewis tossed almost every copy of his own books and all his contributions to periodicals to the WPB." That's what he referred to, the waste paper basket, as he called it, and just as promptly forgot what he had written. And one day, in fact, Walter Hooper was collecting up everything he could get of C.S. Lewis. And one day he found C.S. Lewis throwing it all into the waste paper basket. And Walter Hooper said, "And yet, much as I hang on every word that Lewis wrote, I would happily exchange all for one more conversation with him over tea in the sitting room of the Kilns. But content, we must all remain with the huge legacy he has left us in his writings." Just one other thing before I give you a couple of his letters. That is that I was at a conference in Heber City, Utah. It was by invitation only, and we were discussing radiation effects on biota, on people and animals. It was an international thing, limited to about 40 or 50 people, and that was in about 1957 or 8. And there were some people from Oxford there. And one evening, we all ate together, and there happened to be a group around there, and a couple of them, two of them were from Oxford. And we were just passing time of day in interesting conversation, and we were talking about the people we knew that were good friends, who would have made fine mates, but never married. Which was an unusual subject, I guess, for a bunch of scientists discussing radiation. But they were sort of passing it around, and many of the people we knew. And I says, "Well, how about C.S. Lewis?" And I often do this to a secular audience. And the lady sitting next to me, who I'd known for quite a while, a scientist from Oxford, "Well, he is married. C.S. Lewis is married. By now, you see, he's 57. He was born. You see, by this time, he's 59 years old." And I says, "Oh, no, that can't be." "Oh," she says, "I'm pretty sure. My husband knows him better, and I'm pretty sure. But you talk to Robin Mole, because he'll give you the skin on it." So that evening, I went to Robin Mole and asked him. And he said, yes, C.S. Lewis had recently married a lady from the United States with whom he had corresponded, who had come over to see him before she died because she had incurable cancer. And the last, and he married her. And she had some remission. And in fact, the last he had heard that he had been seen walking with her in his garden. He was a great gardener. He loved the garden. And I didn't know who this was. And I didn't know who she was until after death. And I found out it was Joy Davidman. David. Now, Joy Davidman wrote Smoke on the Mountain.
Davidson.
Are you sure? Davidman. Oh, it's Joy Lewis. But she wrote Smoke on the Mountain, huh? Which is on the Ten Commandments, and it's a great book itself. And she dedicates it to C.S. Lewis.
You're right.
It's David Munn?
Yes.
Seldom am I one up on Karin Buston, especially about books.
Is this on tape?
She is a children's librarian. Pardon?
We've been in Norway country too long. Everything is.
Yeah, she's been taking Norwegian lately. But never take on a Norwegian. She's not fully Norwegian. Three quarters. And what happened was that she did have some remissions, and they were married. What he referred to as a happy marriage. They were 3 years together. But then, it was a great tragedy when she died. He took it very hard, and he wrote a book about it called Grief Observed by C.V. Clerk, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Pardon? And because he did not want his own name put to it till after his death. But it's out now. It's Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis. And so much for that. Now, on letters. He was great. He'd try to answer all the letters he got in his own handwriting, which wasn't at all that great. But it's a little better than Carol Hinderly's, the other Carol Hinderly. So you can make out most of the words. And there's a sample of it in here, and I regret that I don't have mine. But I just wanted to give you. Now, what happened on this? This lady whose name was eventually, her name was Mary, but her identity is not known to you or to me. And at her own request, the identity of Lewis's correspondent is withheld. All her letters are, and a lot of his collection is in the Wheaton College. And there's a big C.S. Lewis society there. A widow four years older than Lewis, she was described by one friend as a very charming, gracious, and southern aristocratic lady who loves to talk and speaks well. Once financially independent, she had fallen upon privation and, what was worse, serious family problems. In due course, Lewis arranged through his American publishers a small stipend for her, which continues until today. But he had never met her, and he only knew her through her letters, and they were very frequent letters. And like, dear Mrs., he's calling, this is early on, he calls her Mrs. here. Oh, I'm glad, and here's a thing worth recording. Of course, I have been praying for you daily, as always, but latterly have found myself doing with much more concern, and especially about two nights ago, with such strong feeling how very nice it would be if God willed to get a letter from you with good news. And then, as if by magic, indeed it is widest magic in the world, the letter comes today. Not lest I should indulge in folly that your relief had not in fact occurred before my prayer, but as if in tenderness for my puny faith, God moved me to pray with a special earnestness just before he was going to give me the thing. How true that our prayers are really his prayers. He speaks to himself through us. He was a great one on prayer, and he wrote a book called Letters to Malcolm, Chiefly on Prayer. And there is where he says how he about his happy marriage. And one other thing, as you might suspect, let me see. Now there's a transition. Now he calls her Dear Mary. I return the compliment by telling you that my friends call me Jack. And all his friends did call him Jack, C.S. Lewis. So if you feel you know him well, you can call him Jack. I'm sorry, the persecution still goes on. I had this sort of thing at school and in the army and here too when I was a junior fellow, and it does very much darken life. I suppose, though it seems a hard saying, we should mind humiliation less if we were humbler. It is at any rate a form of suffering which we can try to offer in our small way along with the supreme humiliation of Christ himself. And then I must also introduce you to him. What did I do that for? Let's see. Oh, Dear Mary. Joy, thanks you for your most kind message. Tells me I am writing to you on George Washington's birthday, so there's glory for you, as Humpty Dumpty would say. God is very good to us, and we could go on happily at present. And what people liked about him, or excited about him, because he knew so many things. He read so many things, and he had good recall except on what he had written himself. He dispensed with that, but he was... And he was conversant in so many subjects. I notice I have, as I have done before in similar circumstances, the common age is a bond stronger than common species. That is, Guppy is friends with the kitten, and Guppy's mother is friends with the old cat, Huge Tom, called Ginger. I bring that up because the chief had a cat named Ginger once, and I'd never told her this, that the C.S. Lewis also had a cat named Ginger. I'm glad my angels should be thought more correct than those of the repository artist, but I just wanted to tell you that he had here's why I had this. Your letter reached me before I left home this morning on my way back to college, this being the first day of term. I came to, that's not important. I'm sorry you have been having trouble with your cat. We have rather an animalic time for our old bitch. We thought she knew better. Made us an unexpected Christmas present of 10 puppies. We are tired of hearing neighbors say, oh, thank you, we'd love a puppy, but... So he had those kind of problems, too. But they were very fond of it, and you see, that next one then tells about how they kept one of the puppies and called him Guppy. And he gets along well with the cat, and I wanted to be sure of that. And then Joy did write her a letter, too. And there's only a couple of letters in here that are not from C.S. Lewis, and that's from his brother, and also from Joy. And so she writes, and then she says, is your pet a cat or a dog? So she must not have been reading all the letters, because he was already speaking of the cat earlier. I found that cats stand these changes and separations pretty well. One of mine, when I was ill, took possession of a new home and mistress, and then had them completely under his thumb in a week. if one can speak of a cat's thumb. So that gives you some introduction to him, and how he tried to answer all these letters, which must have been a fantastic chore in itself. But he took it as a very serious business when anyone wrote him. And even if he felt bad and he'd apologize, like he did to me, that he felt very badly when he wrote this. And now it's Carol's turn.
He was an Oxford Don. He spent most of his life there. I don't know, why don't you just go right ahead?
You should say he was born in Belfast.
Okay, he was born in Belfast.
He was born in Belfast, and his folks, you know, there's...
A lot of the details, that's where I'm sorry.
And then he went off to war, you know. He was in the First World War. And in fact, he got to the trenches when he was 19, right? And he was wounded. And then came back to Oxford. And then you can take him from there. You're
you go right ahead, Leo. This is just a little bit about his teaching, because that's what kept him alive, was being a Don at Oxford and at Cambridge. But he hated to teach. One thing that's always weird about Lewis, and it comes up all the time in the biography and when you read other little comments about him, is that on the outside, I mean, he writes these fantastic books that's so perceptive about the world we live in and about the faith and all kinds of stuff. You know, I mean, he really knows what it means to be human, you know. But he was a terrible snob. You know, and if somebody couldn't converse with him, he'd just, well, that's all. Yeah. He loved to fight, you know, and he'd debate at the drop of a hat over the smallest thing, like at a cocktail party or something.
Pronunciation of a word.
Yeah, somebody make out, just say like a sentence like we all do off the top of our head, and Lewis would say, I challenge that, and they'd be off, you know. Or just pinning people to the wall on the smallest occasion. And, but at the same time, for some reason, sort of in spite of himself, almost, because he didn't care about his undergraduates, he didn't care about tutoring them, he didn't care what they were learning. As long as they were reading the right stuff, that was fine, you know. And, you know, he hated to read their essays and do all that kind of stuff.
Unless they were really smart.
Yeah, well, yeah, there were some. The special ones. Yeah. That he would have to his rooms all the time. I mean, he really did take it, but generally, he hated to teach.
My thing on that is that he didn't read the papers. He'd have the people read them to him, and every time they made a slip or stumbled in the sentence, he'd ask them a question, because when you know what you're talking about, you can read what you write very well.
Yeah.
Oh, that was
and
a frightening experience for him.
And stumble, then he'd ask them a question, and they wouldn't. No. He didn't really read them. He just sat back and listened to them.
And this is a little bit about his teaching, and it gives you an idea about what kind of a character he was, too, which is always kind of fun. This is fun to me in this book. Whether one had read any of his works or not, the first sight of C.S. Lewis was always a surprise. One undergraduate just initiated to lectures as varied as Tolkien, Edmund, Blunden, and, well, we won't go into that. Remember the shock as he sat for the first time in the hall at Magdalen in October 1938, and there strode in a big man with a large red face and shabby clothes, looking like nothing so much as a prosperous butcher, who began addressing his audience in a loud booming voice and with tremendous gusto. Of course, one soon got over this first impression when Lewis began lecturing. It was obvious, even in such utilitarian lectures as his two prolegomena series to medieval and Renaissance literature, that one was listening not merely to a scholar of immense erudition, but to a lover of literature who had read every text he mentioned, had enjoyed most of them, and was eager to share both his knowledge and his enthusiasm with anyone whom he could persuade to do so. Did we mention that his field was medieval literature, particularly English?
And these lectures were often to standing room only.
Right, yeah. Lewis was popularly supposed to regard both lectures and tutorials as a complete waste of his valuable time, and to hold undergraduates in the uttermost contempt. But even if these assumptions had been correct, no one could deny that he gave more fully and conscientiously than most tutors of the very best that he could give. Perhaps the impression of not wasting more time than was absolutely necessary was given by the fact that Lewis did indeed seek to exemplify Kipling's dictum about filling the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run. He lectured for precisely 3/4 of an hour, and he never waited to answer questions. 2 minutes before the end of the lecture, he would quietly gather his notes together, return the watch, which at one time he was in the habit of borrowing from the nearest member of his audience, and prepare to leave, lecturing all the time. Then, if he finished his last sentence, he would step off the podium and stride down the hall at top speed. If he was at all late in arriving at the lecture, he would begin it even before he entered the hall. Several times a great voice came booming up the steps outside the hall door, and Lewis would enter in haste, lecturing vigorously. Later on, he had a watch of his own, but in the Michaelmas term of 1938, at least he was forced to borrow one. The nearest undergraduate chanced to be Roger Lancelin Green, who's one of the authors of this book and was very close to Lewis, who sat almost at his feet and sported an obvious pocket watch and chain. And only he would know, as the watch was returned to him, that the lecture was ending. But not by the wildest stretch of imagination could Green have dreamt that 25 years later, the book built out of those lectures to which he was listening with such interest would be dedicated to him. And then just there's one more paragraph here. Lewis's knowledge certainly seemed prodigious. Every quotation that was not originally in English was given in the correct language, followed by a translation. Norse, Old and Middle English, Latin, Greek, French, German, Italian, even Old Welsh. Although that was probably the only one of these languages which he could not have been able to read unseen with ease. And this next part I thought was really important about Lewis's style, because he, like Leo said, he just wrote prolifically, just poured out all kinds of written stuff. His interest was in the written rather than the spoken word, and on the way to Greece in 1960, when the plane was forced down at Naples by bad weather, he made no attempt to talk Italian beyond the few bare words needed to procure a bottle of Chianti, but he could read Italian, you know, drop a hat. And in Greece itself, he made no attempt to learn even the odd phrase in modern Greek, though during an enforced wait, he picked up a local paper and was soon eagerly translating as much as his knowledge of the ancient language enabled him to do, and was earnestly working out how the meanings of the words had changed. Nero for water instead of Hedor. Ah, of course, Nero from the Nereids. And what certain new or obscure word could mean. Anyway, that's just a little bit in the biography, which is fun, but it gives you an idea of what sort of a... He really was a weirdo in a lot of ways, but, and he wasn't interested in the things of the world at all. Carol can fill in some of that.
Except he liked the wall.
Yeah, walk and stuff.
There's a beautiful book in the bookstore. It's called C.S. Lewis, Images of His World.
Yeah.
It's just beautiful. It's a picture book that shows where he lived, you know, where he walked, places that meant a lot to him, this sort of thing. Besides things like his own map of Narnia. And pictures, the few pictures that there are of him. I was going to say, when you were talking about all the languages that he dropped phrases in it, I think that's one of the places where his snobbery comes out, because in some of his books, he'll just leave you sitting there with a Latin phrase.
Yeah, he won't give that.
When we were going through the Abolition of Man, there were some little phrases in it. Classical Greek that nobody could figure out, because of course up here we have Greek dictionaries and they were so, the terms were so obsolete that we couldn't figure out what they were. Anyway, I was just going to say a little bit about his fiction. Besides the Narnia series that Leo talked about, he has written a science fiction trilogy. It's just excellent. I haven't read all that much science fiction, but it's by far the best that I have read. And
Bradbury is a big name in science fiction. He feels that Lewis's trilogy is the best work of science fiction ever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was sort of before science fiction, because, you know, that was written a long time ago, wasn't it? Before we talked about much interplanetary travel.
I think that was the early 50s.
Yeah, it was early 50s.
Before Flash Gordon?
What?
Well,
is that early 50s you came around?
Outside of Planet is... That can't be right. That's the paper cover.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah. It's the 50s anyway. 20 years ago, anyway.
Anyway, it's early science fiction, I guess. But the last one, That Hideous Strength, which I haven't read, so I really shouldn't talk about it, but from what I understand, it's just a great work of the horror of technology, you know, what could happen, what can happen when it... goes too far out on a limb.
I didn't like it.
Didn't you like it?
I wouldn't like it either, because I...
But it, you know, of the three, I prefer Silent Planet.
Yeah,
and Pearl Andra is a reconstruction of the Adam and Eve story, except they didn't fall. on another planet. But The Hideous Strength, I think, was really a takeoff on Harwell and the big science industrial military combine. You see,
that was on The Hideous Strength. It was said that was to give a fictional presentation of the abolition of man, the last chapter of the abolition of man. And Barfield, I think, felt that The Hideous Strength was one of, you know, Hideous Strength and abolition of man together was one of the best, you know, things that he had done. That was one of
I think it was helpful. It was very frightening. But I just preferred the other two.
Yeah, I like Hideous Strength. But, and it is the only horror kind of book or science fiction book where I have really been scared to death. I had to put it down. You know, I don't scare very easily. Never, I've been
told. And talking about Till We Have Faces, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, Till We Have Faces is his last, and that's a retelling of the myth of Cupid and Psyche, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just excellent. It's sort of, I don't know, takes place in what, about 13th, 14th century England with a royal family. Yeah, Till We Have Faces is his last, and that's a retelling of the myth of Cupid and Psyche, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just excellent. It's sort of, I don't know, takes place in what, about 13th, 14th century England with a royal family. And this whole myth is reconstructed in a way that the title of Till We Have Faces comes out of one part in the end where is it the priest who says
Karin has read it later than I have.
God can't talk. how does that go? Something about God can't talk to us till we have faces. Anne's reading it right now. I haven't got that far. She isn't coming.
You got to read it to find out.
Yeah, read it and find out.
But just the whole idea that until we become persons, until we have faces, God can't really talk to us. Anyway, that's his last, and he considered that his best.
Oh,
what?
It's difficult to find it.
Yeah.
Mm. I think he liked that one best.
Yeah. He really liked that bit. Another one he did was Screwtape Letters, which are letters from the head devil in hell, Screwtape, to his nephew, Wormwood, who was on Earth. Doing his best to tempt people, and he does very fine work. You know, it's really fun to just all the little subtle temptations that these devils come up with, and that I think goes right along with The Great Divorce, which I think is my favorite still. It's just a real short little book that I would really recommend as if you haven't read Lewis before, I would recommend that as maybe the first one, at least of the fiction.
Is that right? The Abolition of Man?
No, The Great Divorce.
Oh, The Great Divorce.
Yeah, did I say Abolition of Man?
No, maybe I didn't. No,
he wasn't heard of.
Why did you just say
it? It sounded like it, you know, but.
Then you're going to talk about Surprised by Joy, too.
Surprised by Joy is the autobiography. But anyway, The Great Divorce is an allegorical bus trip from hell into heaven. And it isn't the idea that we so often get that people are cast out of heaven because they're, you know, they're too bad or something like that. these people who are, or these ghosts that come up from hell, are just given every persuasion, every just every chance to stay in heaven. These people come, angels come down. I shouldn't even use those words words like angels, because you don't get the same, you don't get that idea. You don't get the feeling of people with big flowing wings or anything like that. These are very normal people, only they're very strong, solid people. And they come down from the mountain. What?
Physically solid, too. That was
yeah. They were physically solid, so that the ghosts from hell, in comparison, were almost transparent. They were just wisps of smoke, where these others were just so solid. And heaven itself was so solid that the ghosts could not even walk on the grass without puncturing their feet. You know, so there's just this whole feeling of heaven as solid reality, as opposed to the tininess of hell. You know, and these ghosts were persuaded to stay. What it amounted to was, if they could take their minds off of themselves for 1 second, you know, there would be a chance for that tiny spark of a person within them to be blown into a flame and to experience some of what heaven is, and then to desire to have more. You know. But it's really fun, and it's just about 117 pages or something like that. Very little narrow lines. You can read it in an afternoon.
Is it in the library here?
Yeah, it's in the library. It's also in the bookstore. But anyway, and then Surprised by Joy is his autobiography, which is kind of like I think it's described by somebody as a spiritual detective story or something. Because what it amounts to is, it's the story of his conversion. Sort of the dying away of imagination and that sort of thing in his adolescence. And the total rejection of faith and belief and everything. And then you almost get the feeling that he is being pursued by faith. No. To where he does everything he can to escape it. But finally, I think the last chapter is checkmate or something. And you get this feeling of a detective story, of a chess game, you know. He tried as hard as he could to remain agnostic, and he couldn't do it.
And he worked at it, too.
Sure did.
First he became a theist, and then a Christian. And he was kept going by this old bookstore, you know. And he looked over the stuff of George MacDonald. And then he finally got Unspoken Sermon. And he says, the debt I owe this book is almost greater than one can owe to another. And that was really the turning point.
Yeah, that was Fantasties, I think, by George MacDonald.
Or was it?
What's really fun about it is that what he considers to be the most important thing in his conversion was imagination. He said that this book by George MacDonald, in essence, baptized his imagination. And it was imagination and joy. The title, Surprised by Joy. It was these things that did not allow him to remain agnostic, to maintain his own tight set of beliefs in his own head.
And that really started a kind of a new wave of Christian imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, the Inklings, which consisted of his brother, and Charles Williams, who some of you are reading, and Dorothy Sayers, who is her patron saint.
She was her borderline Inkling.
But she was there. They met every Thursday night.
The same sort of
and Tolkien, who some of you read in The Hobbits and all, Tolkien was one of these. Was Barfield one of these?
Yep. Yeah. Gervase Matthews.
Yeah. They're all dead now. But they would get together and criticize one another's works, but they were all in this sort of new approach to Christian imagination, or most of them.
Yeah, the accounts of those are really fun in that Roger Lassen's biography.
It's in there. Quite a bit on it, huh?
They'd meet in C.S. Lewis's room at Magdalen College and read things to each other, you know, and criticize and I think it was every Thursday night or something.
Yeah.
Sometimes they go down to the local pub. And we were just in Oxford this last year, and we walked by that pub several times. One time we were even going to go in there for lunch, but I didn't remember that was the pub.
Shame on you.
I know, isn't that terrible?
In the introduction to Ethel presented, Charles Williams Lewis says that on Thursdays they met in this pub who had the best ale in Oxford.
Yeah.
And I'd be a fool to reveal the name. But in here they say we're living, it's the B&B.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you'll know.
It's there. If you ever go to Oxford. We spent a lot of time though walking around the grounds and the walks that he liked.
Is that right?
That was fun.
Did you go by the kilns then? That was a little out of town.
No, that's out of town. Anyway, maybe John should say something about abolition of man. Yeah.
25 words of less.
I really don't know how I could do it in a short time, but it's. And I don't want to talk too much and give too much away, but I would suggest reading it about four times. It's very short. It's only, I mean, if you typed it out on a paper, like in a paper form, it would be, 40 pages long. That's about all. But it is one of the tightest arguments I've ever read. I mean, every preposition is chosen with a great deal of care, and and yet it doesn't seem like an argument. It moves very well. You can read it very quickly and think that you've gotten the point, but it's really a book that you have to live with a while to find out the significance of it. And it is very significant anyone, whether they're Christian or not. And I'll just say one other thing. I think it's been a turning point in the Life Enrichment Program, reading that book and discussing it in a marathon way for about 20 hours in 2 days is really a turning point in the Lifestyle Program, and has been ever since we started the program.
Which books do you have them read in Lifestyle? C.S. Lewis.
We started the year with Great Divorce. Then there's Abolition of Man, returning, and then at the usually people read Mere Christianity and Screwtape Letters on the side. We don't have particular discussions about those. And then in the spring we read Four Loves. And I think those are a great place to start in Life Enrichment is about a book about thin-natured people, that's Great Divorce. And then Abolition of Man is a great book because it tells about, without reference to Christ, where a person stands, or what a human being is, and can, he's not proclaiming anything, he's just teaching, he's cutting down brush. Really, in that book. And then in Four Loves, it's since we tend to think, at least in the 20th century, that God, love is God, rather than God is love, he has a book about five words for love. And again, he's cutting down brush. He's taking away misconceptions of what love is. He's being the constant teacher. And that sometimes, if you read him enough, you start, I've read him enough to where I start beating my head against the wall because he's not proclaiming. He is not a preacher. He's a teacher. And sometimes I just, toward the end of his books, I just, you know, now preach, you jerky, and he won't do it. He's a teacher, and that's his call, and he defines, describes, he cuts down brush, he presents things, he clarifies things, and he leaves the last, he lets you write the last, or the couplet. You know, of the sonnet that he's writing, and he's beautiful that way, and that gives him an audience that is far greater than perhaps someone who more particularly be more planting seeds rather than cutting down brush.
The Four Loves is an important book. It was an important book to me, yeah.
I think...
Go ahead.
What I think would be fun to hear from, just briefly, just what's your favorite book? Of people that have read C.S. Lewis, what's your favorite? Just shout it out, we'll see how many we can
Great Divorce.
Great Divorce. How many Great Divorces do we have? That's the very favorite. Fun, Carol? Mm-hmm. What else?
I really like The Four Loves.
Yeah, I like that.
But I enjoyed the Psalms, as I told some of you, and Ralph and I and others were discussing the Psalms. Karen?
What I like, I can't remember the name of the book, but it's short stories. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah.
Really weird ones.
Yeah, some really strange stories.
Boy, you read them and you were really spooked. If you were spooked, have you read them?
In light of C.S. Lewis, all of his writings are listed in the back. All 372.
The Last Battle.
I like the Narnia Chronicles, but I didn't like The Last Battle particularly.
Ready?
Like
the verse
in his four. I like that one.
Those
I like the Silver Chair.
That Narnia series is not just for children. Right?
Yeah, that's a very good point to make. When I give it, it's for children from 5 to 95.
For anybody who can read.
Yeah,
it's a marvelous series for parents to read their children without feeling they're doing somebody a favor.
Yeah,
that's a very good point.